Hello, this is Mark, and I just wanted to say, first and foremost, thank you for downloading this episode of the Waltons Podcast, but I also wanted to mention, I ran into a lot of technical difficulties in this particular episode where I was to interview John Walmsley, and I have to apologize ahead of time. Without going into every detail, everything went wrong. Nonetheless, I think that it's very listenable, that it was a very enjoyable conversation, and I hope that you enjoy it. Please let me know your thoughts, and please just take the technical issues out of the equation just for this particular episode. Future interviews will be far better in quality. John Walmsley is well known for playing, well, he's very well known for playing the role of Jason Walton on the TV show The Waltons. But that's pretty much all he's ever done, which of course is a tremendous joke. while the listeners of this podcast know John from mostly, you know, from the Waltons, if you start looking into the accomplishments that he had, after he got off the mountain, they're pretty massive. He's worked with a lot of amazing music artists, ones that I love, such as, I'm just going to name a couple of my personal favorites, like Richard Marx, fellow Long Islander Brian Setzer, the Doobie Brothers, Michael McDonald, Greg Allman, Merle Haggard, John Mayall, and of course, Strawberry Alarm Clock. And the list goes on and on and on. It's really amazing. But John has also recently released a new album entitled Earl Hamner, A Joyful Noise. And you can purchase it right now exclusively on johnwalmsleymusic.com. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes. But first and foremost, John, I want to thank you so much for putting up with my technical difficulties, but also thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
It's my pleasure, Mark. At least I think it is. We haven't started yet.
it's already become like a tremendous undertaking. I'm so sorry about that.
No, it's fine. It's the problem with technology.
Yeah, the more technology I get, the more complicated everything seems to get. So.
Right.
But so I guess, all right, so first and foremost, I'm aware of your music from the 80s. I'm only new to the Waltons. I just started watching the Waltons maybe 2 years ago. I didn't grow up with it. And I was always a Little House fan. I was one of those, like, Coke and Pepsi type of things.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, I always knew the Waltons. Waltons were kind of like a fixture of, you know, everybody knows exactly what the Waltons are and who you guys are. But I decided to, you know, take the stab and watch it. And I loved it. And it inspired me to start the Waltons podcast. But then I started looking into it and I realized you had, you know, you're not just Jason Walton. you have this huge career outside of the show. And that really blew me away. So I guess first and foremost, if I could just ask you like those basic Waltons questions. Like,
yeah, of course.
So you were born in the UK, I believe.
That's right. That's right.
And you ended up on the most iconic apple pie American show, right? How does that happen? How does that leap over the pond happen and you end up on the Waltons?
Well, my family moved when I was small for the weather.
Mm.
My mother had an uncle, our Uncle Jack, lived in San Diego and said how wonderful it was. And my mother got the bug to move to California, and we did.
Mm.
And I was just always interested in show business, I guess. Always interested in music and television from a very early age. And, you know, one thing led to another. We moved from San Diego to the Los Angeles area. And in 1964, the Beatles emerged on the scene.
Sure.
Who were actually from our home county.
Really?
In England.
I didn't realize. Right? Now it makes sense.
So my grandmother had written to us to me about the Beatles and said, oh, there's these four young boys and they have a band and they're lovely and Johnny will love them, right? This is the story I was getting before the Beatles came to the States. So when they arrived, it was like, oh yeah, these are my guys, you know?
Yeah.
So I thought I personally owned the Beatles, but as it turns out, other people liked them too.
Well, I mean, who knew that you guys were onto something, right?
Right. So I felt very proud of their success, and I had wanted to play music, particularly guitar, for a long time. At that point, I was 8 in 1964.
Wow! So you started very early on guitar.
I did, and I wanted to start earlier. My mother had taken me to the local music store, but my hands were too small. And they said, you know, why don't you come back in a year? So during that time, the Beatles appeared, and the next month, I started guitar lessons. Hmm. I remember the date. It was March 21st, 1964.
So
and I, you know, at that point, I just couldn't wait.
And
any
how
longer.
Old are you
so,
there?
Like every other kid in America, I, you know, picked up a guitar and started lessons.
How old are you there when you were at your first lesson? 10?
8.
Oh, 8. So you didn't wait.
Yeah.
All right, I missed that part. So 8 years old. That is really impressive.
I'd been in the music store at 6 or 7, and mm-hmm. they said, no, you know, come back in a year.
Right.
So I had to wait. And the funny thing was, my dad said, because I wanted a guitar, and he said, oh, I had a guitar. He said, I didn't keep it up. You won't keep it up. I said, no, I will. I really want to do this. And he said, all right, I'll give it 3 weeks.
3 weeks.
Right? Yeah. So I was determined to prove him wrong. So I worked really hard.
Yeah.
You know, and in 3 weeks, I was playing little tunes. So he was kind of amazed. Hmm. And I went from that to playing in little local amateur shows, playing guitar and singing.
Sure.
You know, I'd play at school and I'd play for the Cub Scouts and I'd play for the grandmother's clubs, and, you know, whatever was going. Elks Lodge, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And at one point, I had an opportunity to audition for television. And I got on this local amateur kids show, like a kids talent show that was on Saturday mornings. And I ended up being on that show 3 times and was seen by some television producers and invited to audition for a film.
That's, I mean, and you started so, before the Waltons, you did have a number of roles in other things. So you weren't a stranger to television.
No, I'd done a few shows before that.
Yeah.
I'd been on Combat and Daniel Boone and Nanny and the Professor, My Three Sons a couple of times, just, you know, a whole variety of things. I'd done a film at Disney, and I had done the voice of Christopher Robin in,
sure,
in Winnie the Pooh, and all this happened before the Waltons came along. Now, I started acting in television at 10, so I'd already been doing little music gigs for 2 years, and it really was the music that got me into it. I was always a musician first.
But let me ask you,
stayed that way.
When you started doing television and working on different films, did you start kind of veering away from your love of music and focus on that?
No.
Okay.
Not at all. And I would always take my guitar to the set with me. I auditioned on guitar for the Disney musical I did. It was called The One and Only Genuine Original Family Band. And, you know, other kids went in, they sang or they tap danced or whatever, and I went in and sang and played guitar. And although I didn't play guitar in the film, it was the musical ability that got me into the part.
So one of the things that I don't know if you have found, like, if you even watch television nowadays, but you know how, like, if you watch television and it'll be multiple seasons, you'll really be able to absorb it in a different way than if you'd watched it over the course of years. And being that I watched The Waltons so quickly, I saw this this growth of your character, because your character really really kind of has these like ups and downs and changes, and of course has they write in a lot of this music that you know, that's really a part of your soul, you know, and I'm assuming that that was intentional because of your passion for music. But what's so interesting about it is we get to this point where you really are the musician of the show. Like, it's really like if somebody had to put their finger on like who's the musician, it's you, you know. But then there's a period of the show where it just kind of stops. You know, the World War II breaks out, and it's they take your character, and it's one of the things I found a little upsetting, but it might have been also true for a lot of people. Your love of music vanished, and you became the owner of a pub. And it almost vanished. I mean, it comes back, but to go for the character to go to a prestigious music school and then war breaks out. I mean, of course, war, it ruined everyone's life. And but I think that thinking back on that, I was like, well, maybe that's the most accurate portrayal here, because you had to make a living, you know? And I just wonder if you had ever thought about that, how the character really was going towards music, you know, this passion and love of the art, and then it was kind of taken away from him in the show because of life.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Right, because of the war. Well, as you say, you know, the war took a lot away from everyone, really.
Yeah.
And that would be real life. It's funny because I never thought before that Jason ever went away from music. I think, you know, probably, you know, owning the Doudrop Inn, he was, you know, still playing music in the bar and so on. But, yeah, maybe he had to veer away from the classical career that he thought of having.
But here you are, which, you know.
Like, which, oddly, is what happened to me as well. Because... you know, I started doing music in school when music was offered, when orchestra and band were offered in school. I went that route. You know, I learned to play the cello.
Right.
And so I was playing classical music at school and playing in an orchestra and string quartets and things like that.
Right.
And I learned a tremendous amount. And in high school, I played the flute in marching band. So there was, you know, I learned a lot about music in school, but and I was very serious about being a cellist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I well, because I had some music teachers that I really admired, and I thought, well, you know, that would be good. That would be a good life, and you know, acting is kind of, you know, sort of a risky, feast or famine kind of profession.
Sure.
So I thought, well, you know, I think I'll opt for, you know, going to a conservatory and studying classical music and being a music teacher, you know, maybe in schools. So that was kind of my thought. And I thought maybe I'll, you know, have cello students or, you know, playing an orchestra or something. But anyway, that's what I had in mind. And I was working very hard on the cello. It was like a full-time thing.
It's a beautiful instrument.
And then sorry?
It's a beautiful instrument. It's one of those.
Oh yes,
it really is. And girls love cellists, so that's a good choice.
Do they?
I think they do. I think it's a thing.
Okay. More than guitarists?
Well, you know, I play guitar as well, and I don't know. There are a lot of guitarists in the world. You know, cellist. I don't know. It's not as common.
Right.
It's just my opinion.
Right. Okay. Well, we'll go with that.
All right.
Anyway, then along comes the Waltons, right? And suddenly, at 16, I have a full-time job. Right? And not only a full-time job, but other things to do on the weekend. I mean, flying out on the weekend to do personal appearances and, you know, meetings for the network and, you know, things like that, where they would send you out to a local station and you'd, you know, do interviews and promos for the show and things like that. So I've got this kind of 7-day-a-week job, and, you know, very little time for anything else. And I thought, well, I'm not going to have time to study classical music and go to a conservatory now.
Sure, yeah.
You know, so I thought, well, I'll just go back to playing guitar, which I can take with me to the set, mm-hmm. and I can practice in the dressing room. You know, I'd never given that up, but it was just, it was kind of in the background a little bit more. So I just went, I went with that. Back to guitar, my first love.
I mean, and here you are still playing guitar, right? So I came across a video just yesterday of you playing in Nashville a month ago. Not even a month ago. And you're killing it. It's great. It's like really, really, you're just wailing. You have a great crowd. The actual performance and everything is just solid. And it's just really amazing that you went from this, like, you know, the 8-year-old who has 3 weeks to learn guitar to, you know, now you've played with legends. You've become a legend. You know, it's, you've done all of this stuff. And just a few weeks ago, you're on stage in Nashville, you know. So it's a really amazing, at least from my point of view, it's a really amazing thing to see that. And plus, you're still working on stuff. Like, you just released an album, for instance.
Fine. Well, to be correct, it's actually an Earl Hamner album.
Yeah, so could you talk a little bit about that? So is it music that that he wrote?
No. Earl was not a musician.
Yeah, I wasn't sure.
know of. But Earl had a great love of music. He and Andy Williams were actually good friends,
really?
Which I didn't know for a long time. But yeah, and but as you know, Earl was from Virginia, and there is a great musical legacy in Virginia. For example, the Carter family are from Virginia. Yeah. And they were actually one of the groups that played locally when Earl was growing up. He makes reference to this on the CD. But the CD, let me go back. I got a phone call from Earl, and this was maybe 20 years ago. And he said, I've written some stories. He said, I would like to make a CD. He said, the stories are based on my favorite hymns that my family sang in church back in Schuyler when I was growing up. And he said, I've written a story based around each one, and I would like you to do music for it.
Wow.
So I thought, great. So I jumped at the chance. Obviously, it's many years later. So this CD is being made over a period of many years. In fact, I think the last recording that was done on it was actually this year. I recorded some tracks in England. But this was something that was essentially finished while Earl was alive. So he did hear it. But at the time, he was very involved in the making of a documentary. Some people did a documentary on his life and career. And he said, you know, I think we should wait. Let's wait till the documentary comes out. And then after that, we'll release the CD. And I said, okay, great. You know, whatever you like. And then as the documentary was coming out, Earl became very ill and subsequently passed away.
Right.
Well, then, you know, here I was with this CD that we had partnered on. And I thought, well, now is not a good time to release the CD because, first of all, his family, you know, had his death to deal with.
Oh, sure.
And it was, I mean, it was just awful for all of us. My mother had just passed away.
Oh.
And about 2 months later, Earl passed away. And, you know, this was a great loss for all of us, for his family, for everyone associated with the Waltons, you know, for Earl's fans. It was not the time because, you know, obviously somebody would have said, well, you know, they're just trying to rake in money because he passed away, as often happens. You know, there's all sorts of product that gets released when sure. someone passes away. So, you know, there was never any consideration of doing that. So, you know, fast forward to, a couple of years ago now, because Earl passed away in 2016. And I said to his son, Scott, I said, what do you think about releasing your dad's CD? And he said, I think it's a good idea. So so we kind of decided to release it now, and 2023 would be the year of, it's Earl's centenary. It would be his 100th birthday. Wow. This year. Wow. So, you know, we thought that's a good time. You know, we can release it and it will be a gift to his fans and it will be a tribute to Earl himself.
I think that's awesome. I think that's great. It's also kind of exciting to hear the backstory about it and to kind of understand where the concept and the whole idea came from. I mean, it's really a personal little time capsule for him.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I was listening to it today. Mm-hmm. I get goosebumps when I listen to it, when I hear his voice and his stories, and it is, you know, it's not the Waltons, but it is reminiscent of the Waltons, because he's talking about growing up in Virginia and he's talking about his family and he's talking about going to church and his dad going fishing and, you know, all the things that kind of ended up in Walton's episodes, because what you see in the Waltons are pieces of Earl's life.
Yeah, I would say that this album sounds as though it's a continuation, but it's also kind of it's a different type of Walton story. You know, it's a Hamner story. It's a it's more to, you know, it's more heart, maybe.
It never mentions the Waltons at
yeah,
all.
Of course.
But it does start with Earl saying, when I was growing up in Virginia during the Depression, right? So an association obviously is immediately made.
I think that's great. I can't wait to hear it. I know it's on pre-order right now, and by the time I release this, I'm sure it'll be available.
Right.
But yeah, I think that's really great. How much time did you take to complete the album? I mean, it's been in the works for a while, right? Because you shelved it for a while.
As I say, you know, we recorded Earl's voice probably 20 years ago.
Wow.
Right. And then off and on, you know, over the years, I mean, this was something, as I say, that we partnered on. And so it was, as they say, in the business, a spec project. Mm. No one was paying us to do it. And there was no deadline and so on. Initially, the thought was that Earl would read his stories and I would accompany him on guitar or keyboard. And that was, you know, what he said to me originally. But, you know, listening to the recording of his voice, which is so wonderful, and his stories are so marvelous, guitar, piano accompaniment, it seemed to me, it felt lacking. It felt like his voice deserved more.
Mm.
Because, you know, we're used to hearing his voice on television, where of course there are also beautiful images, but also music and, you know, scoring and sound effects and the whole thing. So I thought that's, to me, is what this needs. It just, his voice justifies that kind of support.
Mm.
And I think we've achieved that. You know, it is like listening to the CD, it's kind of like watching a film without picture.
Hmm. And it kind of reminds me of, like, maybe the concept of maybe when he was growing up. You know, it's a really kind of, like, almost like a radio show is what you're kind of explaining, you know, describing.
Right, I mean, right. And the nice thing about radio shows is that they leave a lot to your imagination.
Sure.
You don't see what's happening. Just like, you know, people are always saying, oh, I liked the book better than the film.
Yeah, right? Of course.
Right? You hear that over and over again. But the reason people say that is because when you read a book, you picture it how you want it to be. You picture things how you... Stephen King said it's telepathy. He said, I don't write everything in my story that you want to see. I think it, but I only write some of it down. Hmm. And then you read it and you fill in the rest. He said, it's like telepathy.
Right. It's like our imaginations have no budget, you know?
What's that?
Our imagination has no budget. It has no limitation. So, right, of course. Right.
Yes. I like that.
Yeah. Well, I come from publishing, so I know how to sell a book.
Okay.
So having to do with the Walton show, did you have the opportunity to keep any like artifacts from the show? I don't know if maybe everything was just kind of like, all right, it's the last day, everybody out, you know, or if
I didn't. I think the only thing I have somewhere is probably the metal plate that was on my parking space.
That's kind of cool though. It's not bad.
It is. It says, you know, Walton's cast John.
Just the J-O-N. It's like you don't need the last name. J-O-N. How many people are spelling it J-O-N, you know?
And let me tell you, we had to fight for those parking spaces.
Was it in your contract to have a parking space?
I don't think so. But you know, most people on most shows on the lot did have parking spaces. I mean, to be honest, how we were treated initially was dreadful. You know, they put there were three, not counting Richard Thomas, who had his own dressing room. There were three boys and three girls.
Yeah.
And they put, you know, three of us in two dressing rooms, right?
Mm-hmm.
So three girls in one, three boys in another. And these were on the stage, and they were just, you know, bits of wood were thrown up to make walls, and then the top literally was chicken wire, right? So I had no real top, and then there was just, you know, above that, it was just the cavernous space of the sound stage. So, you know, that's what they gave us initially, and mm-hmm. then on location, we had these, now this was the 70s, I think these trailers we had were from the 50s, and they were old and rusty.
Oh my God.
You know, getting back to the soundstage. So one day, you know, somebody popped in from Screen Actors Guild and was checking out the dressing room situation, said, well, this is not acceptable. This does not meet Screen Actors Guild, you know, minimum standards.
Uh-oh. Finally, a union stepping in.
Finally, you know, we went from there having these dressing rooms on the stage to having trailers outside the stage where, you know, each of us had a trailer. We each had our own rusty trailer then. So that was the step up they made.
So one of the things I always ask, like I've interviewed a number of people from the Little House on the Prairie production and other productions. And one of the things I always ask people is, what was your first cool car? Or even your first car. You know, some people don't want to answer your first car because, you know, it's one of those, like, security questions. But but what was your first, like, cool car that you were like, all right, this is a luxury?
Right. Well, it was. And, you know, this is a little bit embarrassing to answer in a way. But I will explain. So I guess it was the second... Well, at some point during the first season of The Waltons,
yeah.
I bought a car. I was 16. I became 17 during the filming of that season. I had my driver's license. And I decided I was going to buy, and this was, you know, one of the bottom line models, but I bought a Mercedes diesel.
All right. It's probably still driving.
Sorry?
It's probably still on the road somewhere. You know, it's probably a great car.
It might be. Now, you know, that sounds like a very posh move. I guess it was, because it was probably about twice the cost of some other cars on the road at the time. Because mm-hmm. in 1973, you could buy a car for you know, $2,500 or $3,700. I remember the Mercedes was about $7,000.
Wow.
Which sounds like nothing now.
Oh, yeah.
But then, you know, it was a lot. So I got this car. Now, this was not like the real sporty model. This was a diesel, and it was four-cylinder, right? It was baby blue. It was a very pretty car. I drove to work, right? And you know, diesels kind of have this distinctive sound. So I drove on the lot to the back lot where we were filming, where we did all our exterior scenes. So I drove in there and pulled up, you know, saw somebody, and they said, I think there's something wrong with your car. Because, you know, it was idling, and it was going tick, 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 right?
Yeah.
And I said,
and it stinks.
It's a diesel, right? Because nobody, I didn't know anybody. I'd never seen a diesel car before that.
Yeah.
But one, they said, oh, this will get great mileage. Plus, it's really environmentally sound.
Yeah.
This is really good for the, which turned out to be a lie, yeah. Right?
Uh-huh.
It wasn't true. But the fact is, diesels, as you say, do last a very long time. So I kept that car for 27 years.
Get out of here, really?
Yeah. I drove that car for 27 years, finally sold it. And the woman, funnily enough, that I sold it to was 27. She said, this car was made the year I was born, and it's my favorite color.
That's right? Incredible.
So, that made me feel good.
That's amazing. I love that story.
This was the car that I used to take Ellen Corby to awards ceremonies in this car. We would, you know, pull out and, you know, I'd get a ticket from the valet, and then we'd, you know, walk in, and Ellen would have her, you know, fur coat on, and it was great.
I love that story. And I'm also, I can't believe you kept it for so long. And I bet you it is still on the road somewhere.
It may be. I hope so.
So you mentioned Ellen Corby. And I don't think it's anyone's surprise that you and her had this great friendship and a kinship, really. I mean, you were like family, at least from what I understand.
We adopted each other. Because I had no grandparents at that point, and she had no grandchildren.
I think it's such a sweet story, and it's exactly the way I've read it in a number of places. But one of the things that really stood out to me about Ellen Corby is that she was a TM teacher. She was a Transcendental Meditation teacher. And I've practiced Transcendental Meditation for about 25 years. Did you work with her at all on TM? Is that something that you, I don't know, did she sit with you and do any TM work?
No, we talked about it, but we didn't practice together. But no, she told me a lot about her trips, and she'd been to India and met the Maharishi.
It's amazing.
Yeah, so she was a very hip grandma, as opposed to grandma on the Waltons, who was, you know, very strict, straight-laced.
I would love if grandma met Ellen Corby and just said, what do you mean transcendental meditation? You know, it would be kind of, it would be a real generational shock. The two different types of characters that, you know, one that she's portraying and the one that she is. I think that's amazing. You were friends with Ellen Corby for many years after, I mean, for the rest of her life.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. She was a wonderful woman, and she was very, very supportive of me and my music. Mm. You know, similar to her character on the show, where, you know, the ironing board blues, where Jason is inspired to write the song based on her ironing, and then she's, you know, she's very proud of that, and she always was very supportive to me.
I think that's awesome, especially when you looked at her as such like a mentor and like somebody who you considered family. You know, I think that's That's really amazing. But so you have a real focus on the blues. That's would you say that that's your primary focus throughout your life?
Yes, I would say so. I discovered the blues when I was about 13.
Oh, really?
And realized that, you know, it was basically the root of all the music that I loved. Because as I say, you know, before that, I already loved the Beatles. Mm. But, you know, the Beatles were inspired by American music, like, you know, Chuck Berry and Carl Perkins and Little Richard. And that music all came from the blues.
Sure.
So, and, you know, as I grew as a musician and started to work in various kinds of professional situations, I realized that those were my musical roots as a guitarist. And I would always kind of inject a bit of that in whatever music I was playing. Hmm. So if I had to play guitar on a soundtrack for a TV show, you know, and there would be, you know, written on the music, you know, guitar solo here, and I would improvise something, it would always be blues based. I would always call on that. Mm-hmm. And that got me through just about every kind of, you know, situation where I would say, okay, you know, what am I going to play here? And it was like, oh, okay, well, you know, some B.B. King licks would sound really good here.
Yeah, I mean, and one of the things that is so interesting about your career is in the 80s, you went on tour with Richard Marx. You were in the touring band. And with a keen eye, you can certainly see that you're in a couple of the videos as well. And I say with a keen eye because the quality of the videos are so low in comparison to, I don't know, I think TV seemed clearer back in the 80s when it was on television. But when I watch it on YouTube, everything looks blurry to me. It could also be that I'm getting older. But but with Richard Marx, you know, basically a pop rock band, I'm sure that the style of music that Richard Marx had out there, you could improvise as well. And I'm sure that a blues lick would be very welcome in a lot of that, in a lot of that style of music.
Right.
And that must have been a trip to be on tour with Richard Marx, because he was huge.
Yes. Oh, it was great. It was a great experience. He's enormously talented, great singer, great songwriter. It was a great learning experience for me, because, you know, as a kid, you go to a local venue, you go to, you know, the big arena in your town, and you see touring bands on stage, and there's a headliner and there's supporting acts, and as a kid you think, oh, these guys all have it made. Mm-hmm. Right? Even the opening act, you think, well, they're on stage at Madison Square Garden, so, you know, they must be raking it in, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes you don't realize that sometimes the supporting act has driven in that afternoon in a station wagon.
Oh, totally.
Right? And they showered at Madison Square Garden, right? And then humped their own equipment onto stage, and right? And then after the show, you know, before the headline is finished, they're out the door and driving to the next place, and maybe don't even have a place to sleep that night.
Yeah, being a working musician,
you know, the reality a lot of times.
Being a working musician is absolutely so difficult, and you're absolutely right. There's just so many bands that are well known, and you're like, well, you know, they have to have day jobs because it doesn't pay the bills. it's a really crazy world that we live in that sense.
Yes.
So I just have a few more questions about the Waltons in particular, and just wanted your opinion on it. And that's, so there was a period of time where, when Ellen Corby had a stroke, you know, her health was really bad for a period, and, you know, thank God she actually recovered really nicely, I think, from her stroke, but it did take some time. But at the same time, we lost her counterpart, her, you know, the grandfather, Greer. And I'm just wondering, when that happened, because it all kind of happened in, for the viewer, it happened very quickly. But, of course, there were breaks with filming and everything. What was the buzz like with when all of this was happening? Because you guys, at this point, I'm going to just assume, I'm making a lot of assumptions. I'm going to assume you guys have kind of formed a bit of a family. There's a kinship between these people who none of you are related, but you're working together all the time. You're learning about each other's lives. You're kind of growing up together in a lot of ways. So one and two of the members of your family, one has passed away and one is ill.
Right.
So
right.
I have to imagine that, you know, the tension was very high and upsetting.
Well, it was terribly upsetting, as it would be in a real family.
Of course, yeah.
I mean, it was just the same as that. We missed Will terribly. Of course, Ellen had her stroke first,
yeah,
because she came back to the show while Will was still there. Thankfully. And, we did. You're right about one thing, and that is that we did seem like a real family because we had the good fortune to absolutely hit it off from the very beginning, from day one. I don't know if you've ever had that experience where you meet someone or a group of people and you instantly feel like you've always known them.
Sure, it's like creating like instant rapport with somebody.
That's what happened with this group of people. And it even happened on the homecoming, which preceded the series. But I think, I don't know if it would have happened the same way, let's say with Patricia Neal and Andrew Duggan and Edgar Bergen, who were in Homecoming.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing did with, well, Ellen was in the Homecoming, but with Ralph Waite and Micah Learned, Will Gere. It was very much a family. And, you know, for the kids, you know, the six of us, we were together. Well, we were all together more than we were with our own families.
Wow.
And this included, you know, as I mentioned before, events and promotional stuff, but also, you know, we just go out and do things together. We just go out and eat pizza, or we'd go to a movie, or we'd go to a concert.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Elton John was a guest on our set.
Really? I mean, must have been a trip.
He was fan of the show, and I think, to be honest, I mean, you'd have to ask him. If he were here, I would ask him. I think he had a little crush on Richard Thomas.
Really?
But he came on the set, and we all went off to the commissary together and had lunch. And the thing that I regret about that day is that I didn't discuss music with him. Because Here I was, you know, a musician, and of course he's tremendous. And I thought, I'm not going to do it because then, you know, I'll just seem like a fan, and you know, I don't want to, you know, ask him questions about his career. And it's, you know, it's because it's like a day off for him, and he's visiting the Waltons, right, for fun.
Meanwhile, he would have loved it probably, and that's, you know, it's one of those type of things where, I think you made the right choice, even if you don't think you did. You know, it's like either way, it was great. It's a great experience.
Yeah, but I thought later. I mean, recently I've kind of gone over that in my head, and I thought, yeah, but I think he probably would have just enjoyed to talk about music, not necessarily his music. Like, you know, what records do you like right now? You know, who did you listen to? Was there anybody that you listened to when you were learning to play piano?
Right.
You know, I try to play like B.B. King. Who was it for you? You know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
not just, you know, not, you know, can you sign my album or anything like that?
Yeah, you know, but I bet you've learned your lesson there, and I'm sure you've met and worked with a number of legends, and you didn't let them kind of like pass without asking those questions.
Well, yes and no. You know, the people that I've met and worked with, every situation is different. And some are, you know, very fleeting and casual, and some, like Richard Marx, I toured with for 2.5 years. So that was a very, you know, in-depth experience of touring. And it taught me that, you know, when somebody gets signed to a record deal, that's difficult enough, as you know. But then is when the real hard work begins. And it was harder for him than the rest of us because, you know, we would check into a hotel and we could sleep late and we could get up and go to the sound check about 5 p.m. But he would have been at some, you know, radio station at 9 a.m.
Sure.
Right, being interviewed on. And then he'd be at a record shop, you know, signing albums. And so it was an all day, all night thing for him. Mm. Not just, you know, doing the show like it was for us.
So one of the, you mentioned Richard Thomas, when Richard Thomas decided to leave the show, I would just say that, was it a shock? Did you see it kind of coming?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. Richard from day one had a contract to do, 5 years of the show. Right. And I'm sure. And the funny thing is that he tried not even to do that. He'd done the homecoming and he had a very promising theatrical film career going. So he did the homecoming, which was a, you know, very good project. And then they came to him with the series and he thought, well, you know, I'm getting cast in films, you know, theatrical films. Do I really want to commit to doing a series and not be available for that, or to be thought of as just a TV actor?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? No. Right? What happened was they kept coming back with more money and more money and more money. And finally, he kind of gave up and said, all right, I'll do it. I can't, you know, I can't turn down that much money.
Right.
So he had a really good deal for 5 years. And at the end of the 5 years, he said, obviously, they wanted to keep him, and I'm sure they offered him still more money. And he said, no, I said I would do it for 5 years, and I did, and that's it. And, you know, that's fine. He honored that commitment, and he was incredibly good in that role. And, but, you know, that's kind of what we were expecting.
Did you feel the same way with Michael Learned and, you know, when she left and then Ralph Waite would, of course, leave not too, you know, too soon after.
Right.
When that all happened, I mean, was it kind of like, all right, what do we do? Like, what do we do now? Because I actually thought that the show still remained pretty good. I know a lot of people have issue with this period, this era of the Waltons, but I thought it was still very well written. It still had great heart. You know, my criticism of your character, I think, actually added a lot of storyline, you know, with him taking over the pub and, you know, I thought that the story, I think changing out John Boy was a questionable decision, but, you know, that's neither here nor there.
I do too. I think that was one of the, I think that was one of the most questionable things that the production company did.
Yeah.
Because to be honest, I felt bad for that actor because those were, I mean, he is a very good actor, but those are very big shoes to fill.
Yeah.
And I think possibly to some degree that, you know, was always in the back of his mind as well. You know, Richard said that he'd worked with Robert Whiteman in something else and how good he was, you know, but I think that's always going to be, it's always going to be a toughie to take over. I mean, you need to have some real, some real guts to take over somebody's role, I think, especially when it's an iconic role.
Right. It's, but, you know, I think it was ballsy, and who knows? Maybe it was a decent, it was worth a try. It didn't really work out, I think.
I think the problem, and probably the problem for Earl, who created the show and he was there all the time, you know, hands-on. This was a show about a family through the eyes of the oldest son.
Right.
Who became a writer and was, in fact, Earl Hamner. Mm-hmm. Right? So I think there couldn't be a Waltons without John Boy, because, I mean, there would not have been a Waltons without Earl Hamner. It never would have happened.
Yeah, it would make no sense if they had killed off the character. Just, all right, who's talking? Right. You know, who's narrating this?
Right.
It would be exactly a questionable thing.
So that was tough. And I think one of the greatest things that they ever did, just to, you know, shine a light somewhere else, is bringing Ellen Corby back after her stroke, playing grandma as a stroke victim.
I loved it when she came back. Like, I really, I mean,
me too.
Again, I watched the entire series over the course of maybe 2 months. And so I was blasting through a decade of television in weeks. So when she came back, I was like, this is great. And I started looking up news articles about it and how big of a deal it right. was that she was returning to television. I'm sure you remember it
right.
Like it was yesterday, because it was a real big story. Right. People really cared.
I think no one had ever done that before, and possibly not since.
No. And you know what? It was great to see her back. It really was. I just...
Yes.
That was one of the shining type of the moments where... I mean, even though the story got kind of weird with her, she kind of went... You know, they could have worked out... I'm very critical. They could have worked out a better story as to where she goes and everything. But, you know, they were right. they were just trying to make a TV show.
Right.
So, what... I do want to just mention real quick before I let you go back to your whole life about music again, because I mentioned I'm a guitarist as well. And yes. I love to ask, like, what your first, like what is your favorite guitar that you currently own? You have to have one. You have to have one. Well, everybody has one guitar.
Just one?
Well, you know, I have one particular guitar that I could pick right. up, and I just love this guitar. You know, I love all of the okay. guitars that I have, but this one particular one, it's old. It means a lot to me. It's been through my life, you know? I don't know if you... Maybe right. you don't have one like that.
Right. Well, there's, you know, there's two or three that kind of fit that okay. description. But the probably the first and foremost one is, it's an electric, it's a Gibson 345 that I got new when I was 9.
Is that the BB King
and I'm
guitar?
I'm still playing. Sorry. Yeah, BB played one.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I know that guitar. It's a great guitar.
It is a great guitar. But, you know, aside from that, this is also the guitar that my parents scrimped and saved to buy. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, they realized how hard I was working, and that was their way of being supportive. Mm-hmm. And also, my dad actually wasn't a musician, but he actually had a very good ear, and he was a big fan of Chet Atkins, and he liked that really pretty warm sounding guitar tone.
Right. Yeah,
that I was playing a little Fender, you know, duosonic, and Dad wasn't particularly into the, like, twangy sound. You know, he sure. liked the real warm, mellow, pretty-sounding guitarists.
Yeah. And what about now? What are you playing now? Because I see you're on stage with more modern equipment.
Oh, well, that guitar is very interesting. It's a James Tyler guitar. Mm-hmm. James Tyler is in L.A. and it's a, you know, it's a custom shop place. He's made guitars for a lot of, you know, the session guys and so on. This particular guitar is one that was made in his shop. There was also a Korean version of it. And it was all done in partnership with the Line 6 company.
Oh, I love Line 6.
So it's got this technology built in where, I mean, it's got, you know, very nice pickups, like a, you know, Les Paul type configuration. But it also has a pickup in the bridge, which enables you to have all these kind of samples.
Oh, so it's like Variax technology. The it's piezo pickups.
It is exactly that. Yeah. Variax.
I have a Variax, and yeah, you could play piano on it if you want. It's amazing. Or a sitar guitar. Or
right.
That's
this
incredible.
Is their model that is sort of Les Paul shaped.
Yeah, I love it. It's a beautiful guitar. I was just watching your live performance from October, and it was really, really something to watch.
Yeah, I use it for live shows because I do different tunings for playing slide and so on. Mm. So I can dial that up just by pushing, you know, the volume knob.
That's amazing. No feedback.
It goes in tuning. I have the other knob set for. It'll just switch right over to an open D or open G, or, you know, I had an open F sharp because that's just the key the song was in. So it works very nicely, and I don't have to bring a bunch of guitars with me.
Yeah, I mean, your sound was excellent, of course, but I love that technology because there's no feedback, there's no noise. To me, my experience with the Variax technology, it's instantaneous. Some people complain. I don't know. I don't feel like any type of delay. And I like it.
Okay.
Yeah, I like it a lot. So,
I haven't had a problem with that either. And recently, before this last outing, I'd never gotten into adjusting pickups very much, but I actually adjusted the pickups. The normal pickups on this guitar. Mm-hmm. And what I did was, because I normally use the Les Paul setting for the Variax part of it.
Sure.
So, because it's the most similar to what the guitar is itself. So when I switch from the guitar's own pickups, I we're probably leaving a lot of people in the dust here with this conversation.
I love guitar talk. I should
explain. The Variax is a technology which allows an electric guitar to be played in a number of different tunings and to sound like other guitar models.
Exactly.
So it's an imitation of a Fender or a, you know, a Gretsch or a Rickenbacker or whatever it is. So anyway, that's the
the nerd talk. It's like, welcome to nerd talk. It's guitar nerd talk.
Guitar talk.
That's my Long Island accent coming out there. But John, I just want to say thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
Of course.
I'm sorry about the technical difficulties. I'm sorry to the people listening, but I'm going to do my best to fix this up as much as I can. But yeah, everyone has to head over to johnwalmsleymusic.com. I'll put the link in the show notes and promote it on the Waltons podcast.com. And, you know, I'm really looking forward to checking this out. I didn't know it was going to be a spoken word type of thing with Earl Hamner on the album.
Yes.
That sounds really awesome. Like, I'm really looking forward to checking that out.
So it's spoken word by Earl and music by myself and my collaborator, Patrick Copeland, who is a wonderful keyboardist, engineer, producer. He mixed and mastered the album, and basically I did all the strings, he did all the keyboards.
Well, I guess the only question left is, like, what's next? Do you have any projects in front of you?
I have a few different ideas in mind. Definitely another blues CD.
Cool.
That's one of the things. But I think I'll just kind of keep the other things under my hat at this moment. But more music. More music.
That's always awesome. It's who you are since you were 8. You had 3 weeks to become a musician, and here you are, That's awesome. But again, John, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
When I was a boy growing up in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia during the Great Depression, I thought that no one could have quite so good a life. We were a traditional Virginia country family. It was made up of my mother and father, my 3 sisters, 4 brothers, and 2 sets of grandparents. I was the eldest. We are told in the Bible to make a joyful noise unto the Lord. Our family did exactly that. With our hair combed and our faces scrubbed within an inch of our lives and all dressed up in our Sunday best, we would head for the Baptist church down the road from where we lived. My sister Marion led the way. She was the feisty one and often got in fights, usually when she was standing up for one of her younger brothers. Most of the time, we'd arrive at the church just in time to join in the opening hymn. Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty, early in the morning our song shall rise to Thee. Holy, 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 merciful and mighty, God in 3 persons, blessed Trinity. Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty, all Thy works shall praise Thy name in earth and sky and sea. After the opening hymn, we youngsters would be sent to Sunday school. We learned the catechism and sang children's songs. Jesus wants me for a sunbeam, a sunbeam, a sunbeam. Jesus wants me for a sunbeam to shine each day for Him. Those words confused me. I knew that I was a wicked little boy. When my parents made me do chores I didn't want to do, I said bad words under my breath. I knew that Jesus would see how bad I was. Why would He want me for a sunbeam? It was very confusing.